am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, friend. I'm so glad you're back. Settle in, because we're not starting fresh today. We're in the middle of something. You remember Frances Willard, don't you? Last time I told you how one woman took a temperance movement built around kitchen tables and turned it into something that stretched across oceans, the world's WCTU, she called it, and I watched it cross the Pacific like a seed carried on the wind. That was two episodes ago now. Before her, further back, there was Abby Kelly Foster, who I told you planted the very first root of this. Women's voices growing up out of the fight against slavery, a full generation before anyone else. Root. Then network now. Soil. Today I want to show you what happened when that seed Frances scattered found a patch of ground on the other side of the world, ready for it. A small country. A handful of islands at the bottom of the map, and a woman there who did something with paper and patience that I still find remarkable all these years later. This is a 7-part story, and we're only 3 steps in. So come close. Today belongs to Kate Shepherd and to New Zealand, and to a roll of paper so long it had to be unrolled across the floor of a parliament to make its point. I was there in the gallery the day they brought it in. Not it. Them. Sheets and sheets of paper, pasted edge to edge by hand, rolled up tight as a bolt of cloth. Two men carried it between them, and I remember thinking, whatever that is, it's heavier than it looks. Paper isn't supposed to have weight like that. They set it down at the front of the chamber, and someone, I want to say it was Sir John Hall, though memory softens names after a century, began to unroll it. It didn't stop. He walked it forward, and it kept going. Down past the front benches, down the center aisle. Members of Parliament actually stood up from their seats to let it pass, some of them laughing, a little embarrassed, the way you laugh when something is bigger than you expected and you don't quite know where to put your face. Others went very still. I watched one man's jaw tighten as his own name, or maybe his wife's, occurred to him somewhere in that endless column of ink. It kept unrolling until it had gone the entire length of the room, floor to floor. A parliament, measured in paper. I want you to sit with that image for a second before I tell you what it was. Not a speech, not a march, not a single voice raised in a dramatic moment, the kind that makes for a good painting. Just paper. Names. Ordinary women, most of whom would never set foot in that building, each adding one small mark to something too long to hold in two hands. 31,872 of them, to be exact. I didn't count them myself. I promise you, even I have my limits. But that's the number history kept. And here's the part that stayed with me longest. It wasn't even their first try. It wasn't their biggest ask either, not at first. This was the third petition. The third time these women had gathered their names and carried them to that same building after being told no twice before. I remember thinking, watching that paper unroll and unroll and unroll. This is what patience looks like when it finally runs out of room to be patient in. Let me tell you how they got here. I'd known Kate Shepherd for years before that day, though she didn't know that, of course. None of them ever do. She wasn't born to this. Catherine Wilson Malcolm. Kate, she preferred, always trimming the formal down to something warmer, came into the world in Liverpool in 1848 to Scottish parents who moved the family around more than most. Liverpool, then Birmingham, then London, then back to Scotland after her father died young. She was clever in the way that shows up quietly. She could reason like a lawyer and sing like it mattered. And her uncle, a minister up in Nairn, gave her something else too. A taste for the idea that faith without justice attached to it wasn't worth much. In 1868, her sister's letters from the other side of the world did what letters like that always do, made a strange place sound like the answer to an ordinary problem, better prospects for the sons, a grandchild to meet. So the family sailed for months all the way down to Christchurch, New Zealand, arriving in the cold hush of February 1869. I want you to picture Kate there in those early years because it matters. She wasn't plotting anything yet. She married a shop owner named Walter Shepherd in 1871. She taught Sunday school. She sang solos with the Rickerton Choral Society, and the newspaper said kind things about her voice. She sat on committees for the YWCA, raised her son Douglas, lived an entirely respectable, entirely unremarkable colonial life. Then, in 1885, an American woman named Mary Levitt came through Christchurch on a speaking tour for the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the very organization Frances Willard was, at that same moment, stretching across the globe like a net thrown wide. Levitt didn't only talk about the dangers of drink, she talked about women needing a voice in public affairs. I watched the room that night. Women who had never heard anyone say such a thing out loud, in public, without apology. Something in Kate caught. By 1887, she'd been appointed the WCTU's National Superintendent for Franchise and Legislation, Willard's global network, handed now into one determined woman's care on the far side of the world. And what she did with it wasn't dramatic. It was relentless, and it was patient, and it happened in stages. I want you to hear in order, because the order is the whole point. 1887, a female suffrage bill, and it failed by exactly one vote. 1888, Kate wrote a pamphlet, 10 Reasons Why the Women of New Zealand Should Vote, and mailed a copy to every single member of Parliament. 1890, the first petition, just over 10,000 names, it failed in the upper house by two votes. 1892, a second petition doubled, just over 20,000 names, it failed again, tangled in procedure. 1893, a third petition. Kate promised it would be bigger still, and it was nearly 32,000 names, the largest petition of any kind ever presented to that parliament. Pasted sheet by sheet onto rolls of wallpaper at her own dining table, because nothing else in the house was long enough to hold it. That's the petition I watched them carry in. That's the paper that wouldn't stop unrolling. Three tries, three defeats before it. And every single time, instead of shouting louder, instead of a single grand gesture, she simply came back with more names. Here's what I want you to understand about what those repeated defeats actually meant in the moment to the people living inside them. It would have been so easy, understandable even, for this to have turned into something louder. History is full of movements that met a locked door and decided to break it down. Marches that ended in arrests, hunger strikes, women chained to railings, women who set fires, women who were willing to become martyrs, so that the cause would have a story bloody enough to be impossible to ignore. I've watched all of those, too, in other places, other years. I understand why they happened. Doors don't always open on request. But in Christchurch, in Wellington, in those quiet rooms where Kate and the other WCTU women met to plan, something different was being claimed, something almost more radical for how unassuming it looked. The claim was this: a government that governs half its people without asking the other half isn't fully legitimate yet. Not isn't kind, not isn't fair, isn't legitimate, and the way to prove that claim wasn't to frighten the government into submission. It was to out-argue it, patiently, with paper and names and math it couldn't ignore. I think that's why the repetition mattered so much. Why 1887's defeat didn't end things, and 1890's didn't, and 1892's didn't. Each time Parliament said no, the answer wasn't retreat, and it wasn't rage. It was ask again, better organized, with more names attached to the asking. There's something almost startling in that choice, once you sit with it. It assumes the people saying no are reachable. It assumes consultation is stronger than confrontation, that a large enough gathering of ordinary voices, offered again and again in good faith, carries a kind of weight that force never quite manages. Because force can be resisted, but a nation's own conscience, shown to itself in ink, is harder to look away from. I remember something Kate wrote around this time that I've carried with me since. All that separates, whether of race, class, creed, or sex, is inhuman and must be overcome. She wasn't only talking about ballots. Listen to how wide that sentence opens. Race, class, creed, sex, all in one breath, all named as the same wound. This was never really about one narrow permission for one group of women. It was about a much larger conviction that separateness itself was the thing to be dismantled, and the vote was simply the door closest at hand. And then there's the small human moment at the very end of it. The moment almost no one remembers because it isn't dramatic enough to make the paintings. On the 19th of September, 1893, the bill needed one more signature. the governors, David Boyle did not support women's suffrage. He was slow to sign. I watched him delay it as long as he reasonably could, but he signed it anyway. Not because he'd been persuaded in his heart, because the accumulated weight of the request, 3 petitions, 32,000 names, years of patient proper asking, had become quite simply harder to refuse than to allow. That, to me, is the quiet miracle hiding inside this whole story. Not that women got the vote, that an entire structure of power, reluctant, unconvinced, dragging its feet the whole way, could still be moved by nothing louder than paper, offered again and again in good faith, until refusing it cost more than granting it ever would. What New Zealand gave the world that September wasn't a new idea. The idea that women deserved a voice in how they were governed had already been spoken, written, argued in dozens of places before this. What New Zealand gave the world was something rarer. Proof. Not a theory of what might happen if women could vote. An actual nation functioning the day after and the day after that with nothing broken. No collapse of government. No dissolution of the family. None of the disasters that had been so confidently predicted by the men who'd voted no in 1887 and 1890 and 1892. Just an election. 10 weeks later, in which 88% of newly eligible women managed to enroll on short notice, and nearly 70% of them turned out to vote. The sky stubbornly did not fall. That matters more than it might sound like it should. An idea that only exists as an argument can always be argued back down. An idea that exists as a working example, a small, stubborn, real country going about its business with women in the voting booth, is much harder to unmake. New Zealand became something other suffrage movements elsewhere could point to and say, it has already been done, and the world did not end. That's a different kind of weapon than rhetoric. It's evidence. I think, too, about what this reveals of the seed Francis Willard had scattered so wide. It had traveled the whole distance around the globe by the time it reached these shores, and here, in this particular soil, among these particular women, it grew into something recognizably itself. Organized, mainstream, parliamentary, patient. A seed doesn't forget where it came from, but it also doesn't grow the same way twice. Because I'll tell you a secret, since you and I are close enough now for secrets. This same seed in this very same year, in this very same small country, was already taking root in other soil too. Soil that looked nothing like Kate Shepard's tidy committee rooms. There were women fighting for this same vote from behind sewing machines instead of pulpits. There were women for whom this fight wasn't really about this vote at all, but about a much older authority they'd never been asked to surrender in the first place. I'm not going to tell you those stories yet, but I want you to hold the shape of this one loosely, because it's about to be handed to you again, wearing different clothes. Every tradition I've ever watched has its version of this pattern. The modest offering that outlasts the grand gesture. A widow's small coin worth more than it looked. A single thread returned to again and again until the pattern finally shows. 31,000 names, pasted onto wallpaper because nothing else in the house was long enough, turned out to be exactly that kind of offering. Here's the part I want to leave with you today. Because it's the part that hasn't stopped being true. You live in a world now where this pattern, the one Kate Shepard and those 32,000 women practiced almost by instinct, is everywhere. So ordinary, you barely notice it anymore. Public comment periods, ballot petitions, community meetings where people show up again and again on the same issue, defeated one month, back the next with a better argument and more names behind it. None of that looked inevitable while it was happening. It looked, most of the time, like slowness, like asking too much of people's patience. I promise you, in 1887, after that one-vote defeat, nobody in that room could have told you with certainty that 1893 was coming. They just kept showing up. That's the thing about consultation as a way of moving the world. It rarely announces itself as effective. Force announces itself. A single dramatic act announces itself. But a plural, patient, many-voiced return to the same locked door again and again in good faith. That looks, from the inside, almost indistinguishable from failure right up until the moment it isn't. I want to say something to you plainly without dressing it up. You live in a world that already assumes women and men share equal claim to a voice in how things are governed. You didn't have to be convinced of that the way David Boyle had to convinced, reluctantly dragging his feet in 1893. It's simply part of the water you swim in. That wasn't always true, and it isn't automatically permanent. Nothing built by people stays built without people continuing to tend it. But it is true now, in you, as a kind of inherited furniture in the room you were born into. That's worth pausing on. Something that took 32,000 names and 6 years of repeated defeat to establish, you now carry as an assumption you don't have to argue for. Here's what I've come to believe. Watching this pattern recur across centuries and continents, the outcome, the wider, fairer, more genuinely shared world, was always going to arrive. Not because it was easy or because the people working toward it were certain, but because that's simply the direction things move, given enough time and enough honest effort. What was never fixed in advance was the path. Kate Shepard's path ran through petitions and pamphlets and parliamentary procedure because that was the soil she stood in. Somewhere else, the same destination was reached by an entirely different road. There are more paths to an inevitable place than anyone can count. But every single one of those paths, in every place I've ever watched it happen, required the same unglamorous ingredient. Real people doing something real, on the strength of a belief in an ending they might not live to see. That's what faith actually looks like when you catch it in the act. Not a feeling kept quietly inside someone's chest, but a name added to a list again after the list had already failed twice. Belief turned into an errand. Belief turned into paper. 31,872 small acts of that kind of faith pasted end to end until the floor of a parliament wasn't long enough to hold them. So let me ask you something, gently, and then I'll leave it with you. Is there something in your own life you've asked for more than once? Something you were told no to, not cruelly maybe, just not yet, not like this, try again. And you had to decide, quietly, whether again was worth it. Maybe it wasn't anything as large as a vote. Maybe it was smaller and closer than that. A change you kept pushing for at work that kept getting tabled. A conversation with someone you love that you've had to return to more than once because the first attempt and the second didn't quite land. A cause you've added your name to, a petition, a donation, a single vote in a small local election. Not knowing, not able to know, whether this would be the year it finally mattered, or just one more sheet added to a roll that isn't long enough yet. I don't have an answer for you here. I don't think this kind of question wants one. But I'd ask you to notice this week what you're willing to ask for twice, three times, what you're willing to keep offering unglamorously without the guarantee of an ending you'll get to see. Because somewhere right now, someone is pasting their name onto a very long piece of paper for a reason that hasn't succeeded yet. And they don't know, any more than Kate Shepard's women knew in 1890, whether this is the attempt that finally reaches the end of the room. Three down, four to go. We're at the midpoint now of these seven, and I want you to feel that shape settle in for a moment before we part today. Abby Kelly Foster gave this story its root. Frances Willard gave it a network wide enough to cross an ocean. And today, Kate Shepard showed you what happens when that network finds soil ready for it, the seed's most expected shape, grown up through committees and pamphlets and paper rolled so long it filled a parliament floor. Mainstream, patient, procedural, exactly what you'd predict if you were the kind of person who predicts such things. But I told you a secret a little while ago, and I haven't forgotten it. That very same year, in that very same small country, this fight was already wearing other clothes. Next time, I want to take you back into those same rooms, that same 1893, but through a different door entirely. Her name was Harriet Morrison, and she wasn't arguing from a pulpit or a committee chair. She was standing on the floor of a garment factory, among women who sewed for wages too thin to live on, trying to build a union strong enough to be heard. For her, the vote wasn't a principle to be reasoned toward. It was survival made political. Same win, same year, seen from the sewing floor instead of the gallery. I think you'll find it changes how the whole story looks once you've stood in both places. Until then, I hope this week you find one thing worth asking for twice. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.